Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. I'd like to welcome everyone. We are continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. Today, the topic, epigenetics, behind emotions, beliefs, and behaviors. My guest, Dr. Bruce Lipton. Dr. Lipton is an international authority on the emerging biology into cellular activity and the interface between science and spirituality. From 1987 to 1992, he was a researcher at the Stanford University School of Medicine. Among his unique discoveries was identifying a mechanism in cells that function like a brain and the founding of a field of cellular biology known as epigenetics. Today, Dr. Bruce Lipton is recognized as a leading voice in the new biology and mind-body medicine. A decade ago, Bruce's book, The Biology of Belief, became a landmark work uniting mind-body and cellular science with spirituality and introduced the latest discoveries in molecular biology and quantum physics in the emerging field of epigenetics. His other books include Spontaneous Evolution and The Honeymoon Effect, The Science of Creating Heaven on Earth. And you can learn more about Bruce and his online courses and his speaking appearances at his website, Bruce Lipton, that's LIPTON.com. Nice to have you with us today, Bruce.
Gary, I am so excited to be here because we're in a state of flux, as you keep talking about, and an evolution is happening, and part of that evolution, as you mentioned, is epigenetics, so a wonderful topic to free people up.
Good, and I'm going to tie, if you don't mind, tie in some of what I'm observing in different groups, and I'm going to hit group by group and then ask for you to break down from your perspective what piece is the puzzle that we can fill in by some phenomena, and phenomena that we are all observing. So that is coming just in a few minutes. But I want to start by looking at over 100 years now, there has been this debate between Darwin and Freud for how a person's behaviors develop and then persist. And we observe this not only in a single person, but across generations as well as within a family line. So this debate has been, is nature or nurturing what dominates your beliefs and behavior? Is it biology or psychology? Or is it both instead of an either-or choice? And the discipline or area of research known as epigenetics is the study of this gray zone between biology and psychology, between genetic changes and the impact of our psychology and lifestyle and choices in the environment in which we live, and of course, most of all, free will. We know from more and more scientific studies that certain feelings and emotions and habits can produce changes in the DNA of later offspring. For example, a Duke University study found that mice fed a diet rich in methyl groups would produce offspring with its fur pigment completely and permanently changed. So if diet and chemicals can cause epigenetic changes, how about our experiences? How about being raised in a family of love or raised in a family of abuse or a family of neglect where you get neither love nor abuse, but you're simply not given the attention that you need? And will that then lead that neglect or abuse or indifference? Could that lead to a person growing up and being altered in their perception? And I'll give you a very specific example, so it's not vague. I've counseled an individual who is successful in their economic life, but on a personal level, the person's had nothing but failed relationships with everyone. This person says that sooner or later, their own dominance, meaning this person's dominance, always needing to dominate, get the last word in, and becomes very abusive. And if people don't do what this person wants, they become extremely aggressive. and almost to a sociopathic level. And now they're at an age where they're alone, they're lonely, and they're angry. And I've asked this many times, this person, will you ever take any responsibility for what you have created? And this person has yet to do so, always coming back to, well, my father abused me when I was a child, physically abused, no, but I knew he wanted to, and my mother didn't defend me. And then we have to ask, can we use as an excuse for not using free will and our own spiritual qualities to overcome the abuses of our past? Or are we simply forever helplessly condemned to whatever we didn't get, then looking in all the wrong places to make sure that we don't get anything other than that? Could you explain epigenetics from the things I just shared with you, please?
I absolutely would, because it's one of the most important issues today, and that is the concept of epigenetics reveals that the environment and our perception of the environment are what regulate our genetic activity. The complete idea of genes turning on and off that we have been sold for 50 or more years is a complete falsehood. Genes have no capability of regulating themselves. Genes cannot turn on and genes cannot turn off. And the concept that genes even know what they're doing is a fallacious idea. It's just that genes are blueprints, the same as a blueprint in an architect's office. The relevance about that is if you ask an architect, is your blueprint on or off? They would look at you like, well, you're crazy. It's no on and off. And I go, well, this is precisely true about genes. It turns out that the equivalent of a contractor is the mind. The mind selects the blueprints, the genetic blueprints, and the most important understanding is this. The mind can alter the readout of any blueprint and alter it so that the readout, I can create several thousand variations of readouts. So, well, what is a readout? Let's say, what is a blueprint and gene? A piece of DNA that codes for a specific protein. And you say, okay, what's the relevance? Proteins are the building blocks of the body. Like a Lego set, there are about 100,000 different proteins, and the way you assemble the proteins creates the structure. So basically, in our cells, there's a nucleus with genes in it. We have about 19,000 genes, and these are the programs to make the building blocks. And for each different type of tissue or organ, different genes are used, and so out of the nucleus, certain blueprints are pulled up. The significance is what is responsible for pulling up the blueprints and what is responsible for now understanding that we modify the blueprints, and that is the environmental information in which the cells live. Simply, when I did an experiment years ago on cloning stem cells, and stem cells are embryonic cells, I created about 50,000 genetically identical cells from one single cell, that's cloning. And I split the 50,000 cells into three different petri dishes, and I changed the chemical composition of the culture medium in which I grow the cells, slightly change it in each dish. And one dish, in, let's say, environment A, the cells form muscle. In the second dish, environment B, slightly different environment, the cells form bone. And in the third dish, yet a different environment, C, the cells form fat cells. And what this blew my mind about was I was teaching people about how genes control life, and then here's the example of an experiment that shows, look, all the petri dishes have genetically identical cells in it. So there's no difference between the genes in one dish and another dish, but if one becomes muscle, one becomes bone, one becomes fat, the question is, what controlled that? And the answer was the composition of the culture medium. As I changed the chemistry, different genes were engaged. Now you say, okay, well, what's the relevance of that? And I say, well, a human body is like a skin-covered petri dish with 50 trillion cells inside, and we make a culture medium, and that's called blood. In fact, when I make a culture medium in a laboratory, I look at the composition of the blood from the organism in which I get the cells. Like if I'm growing mouse cells, I look at mouse blood composition and try to make a culture medium based on that, or when growing human cells, look at the composition of human blood and then try to synthesize that and put that in a petri dish. So what's relevant is that in our bodies are 50 trillion cells in a culture dish. It's being fed culture medium, and the chemical composition of the culture medium determines the genetic activity. That's just the same. Whether the cell's in the plastic dish or the cell is in the skin-covered dish, it still responds to the chemical composition of the culture medium. And I go, oh. And then the next most important step is, well, what controls the chemical composition of the culture medium? I say the brain is the chemist that's adding things or taking things out, regulating the blood. And then the last final question that becomes now the most important one is, okay, the cells are controlled by the composition of the blood. The composition of the blood is controlled by the brain. But then the question is, well, what chemicals should be put in the blood? And this is the part where the mind comes in, because the mind is between the environment and the cells. And it's the function of the mind is to interpret the environment. And then the brain is to take that information and translate it into chemistry to create a behavior that matches the environment. So if you're in an environment of love, the chemistry that comes out of a brain is very supporting of health and harmony. As you know, people in love, they glow, they're very healthy. And I say, yeah, but if the same person all of a sudden is being chased by a saber-toothed tiger, the brain changes the chemistry instantly, puts all the stress hormones in there, and all of a sudden this person is running like crazy from the tiger. And I say, well, what's controlling all this? And the answer is the interpretation of the environment by the brain. And why it's relevant, and it's so important because of the work you described so well, Gary, is that then the chemistry that comes out of the brain is an interpretation of what's going on, meaning you could have the right interpretation of what's going on in the environment, or you could have a misperception, a misinterpretation. I say, what's the difference? Well, if you're reading the environment correctly, then your biology is adjusting completely to the environment and you're in harmony with it. But if you read the environment incorrectly, then the chemistry no longer is in harmony. And as a result, it changes the genetics. So a person running from a saber-toothed tiger has a completely different composition of their culture medium, their blood, than the person that is in love. And I say, oh, so then our biology is controlled by how we see the world. I go, absolutely it is. And then this becomes important because I say, well, then how do you see the world? And now we come down to the crux of the biggest problem in the world is we see it through the mind. I go, yeah, but now here's the important part. We are aware there's a conscious mind. We are aware there's a subconscious mind. I go, they have two different functions, and they learn in different ways. And that's where the conflicts of our world comes from, because there's the conscious mind, which is connected to who we are, personal identity, your spirit. Who are you? That's lodged in your conscious mind. You, as an entity, in a sense, is living in the conscious mind. I say, what about the other mind? I say, the subconscious mind, much more powerful mind. But that mind doesn't have anybody in it. That mind is a record playback device. It records behavior, and when you need that behavior, you push the button, and it plays it back. And it's a wonderful device. I mean, look at it this way. When did you learn how to walk? When you were an infant. I say, well, why is it relevant? Because once you learn how to walk, and it became a program in the subconscious mind, you never had to think about it again. So the subconscious mind is very valuable, because if we have good programs in there, when we push the button, we can replay a program without relearning it again. And that helps us keep moving forward in life. Otherwise, every day, if you didn't have the subconscious mind, every day you'd wake up and the first thing is, well, how do I walk? You'd never get anywhere. So subconscious mind's good unless, and here it is, some of the programs in there are actually not very good programs. They're programs that take away your power or your abilities, things that we learn that actually limit us. And so now here's the problem. Where do the programs come from? Well, the conscious mind can create programs, but the conscious mind does not actually begin to function as a predominant brain state until after age 7. And the reason is this. If I can give an analogy, it'll make sense. And it goes like this. I go to the Apple store. I buy a brand new iPod. And on the front of the iPod is a screen they call the touch screen, where you can create a playlist and adjust the EQ and go fast forward. You can create with a touch screen. So I say, okay, I got a brand new iPod. Take it out of the box. And on the touch screen, I push play. And nothing happens. And, of course, some little 5-year-old kid next to me looks up and says, hey, mister, it can't play until you download some music first. In other words, you have to have some programs in there before you can select the play. And I go, this is true for the mind, that a child, if it was just born and was capable of being conscious and thinking, and the baby is just born, and you say, hey, tell us something, that child will look at you confused, going, I don't know anything, I just got here. There's no program, there's no understanding, there's nothing. So nature created the first 7 years to create the programs by which you carry out your life. And I say, well, how do you create them? I say, the first 7 years, your brain is in a state of hypnosis. It records the behavior of your parents, your siblings, and your community, and watches all those behaviors, and like a recorder, records those behaviors. So the behaviors that are being programmed into your memory base, so that when you're conscious at seven, you have programs, those programs came from other people by necessity, because you had to observe other people to download those behaviors. So, fundamental point. In order for the conscious mind to work, it has to have programs. The first 7 years is programming, but the programs that are installed are not yours, or they're not even filtered by your conscious mind because it's not even working. They're just being downloaded. So you observe the people around you, you download their behavior, and those are the fundamental programs. When you're at age seven, your conscious mind now can select the programs and can work with the programs. And conscious mind being creative can even change the idea, but it doesn't change the program. It just changes the behavior at the moment. Now I say, why is it relevant? And here's the crux of the human problem on this planet today, and that is this. Our conscious mind, being creative, has our wishes and desires and what we want. The man you talked about would love to have great relationships. Yes, that's a conscious mind. He's really looking for it, and he'll keep looking for it because his conscious mind has wishes. And then I have to tell you, here's where the problem comes from. The conscious mind is not only the creative mind. When you're in the conscious mind, it's like you have your hands on the wheel. You're driving your biology and your behavior with your conscious mind. Your hands are on the wheel. You're driving it. But when the conscious mind is thinking, so if I ask a person, I say, what are you doing on Wednesday? And they try to think of an answer. I say, well, where's the answer? Inside their head. So when a thought is occurring, the conscious mind lets go of the wheel and starts to go in the head to think about that thought. I go, well, that doesn't mean just because you have a thought, everything in your life stops. If you're walking down the street and you have a thought, all of a sudden the conscious mind lets go of the wheel. It's in the head. It doesn't mean you just stand there frozen. You keep walking. Or if you're driving the car and you have a thought, you keep driving. I go, well, if the conscious mind's busy, then who's driving it? And here's the answer. When the conscious mind's busy, control by default is sent to the subconscious mind. Well, that's the one that knows how to walk and how to drive the car and how to talk because of habits. They've learned all these things. So I go, okay, then what is this? And here it is. This is it. We believe we are running our lives with our wishes and our desires. Yet, science has revealed that our mind is in thought 95% of the day, and for most people, actually, about 99%. I say, why is it relevant? Well, if your conscious mind is in thought, by definition, it's not driving the vehicle. I say, yeah, but I told you the vehicle doesn't stop. It's just keep moving. I say, yeah, because the default, the autopilot, is the subconscious. It knows how to do the things you normally do. So basically, when your mind is in thought, you automatically switch to control by the subconscious. I go, yeah, but the programs in the subconscious, remember, most of the valuable programs are the ones you got in the first 7 years. The programs in the subconscious didn't come from you. They don't answer your wishes or desires. They express behaviors that you wouldn't even want, but you copied them from somebody else. So the character you talked about says, look, I'm looking for relationships, and then they turn all abusive. And it's like they turn abusive because 95% of the day that person is playing his father's program. That's how he got the program. He downloaded it in the first 7 years. And because he's thinking 95% of the day, he's defaulting to those abusive programs. And I go, what's relevant? And the answer is this. Because the conscious mind is thinking, it means at that moment when the subconscious is going, the conscious mind's not paying attention to that. It's thinking. So the behaviors that come out when you're in thought are not observed by you. And therefore, if they're negative behaviors, you're the one that doesn't see it. So in my lectures, Gary, what I give an audience, I talk to them, I say, look, I'm sure you had a friend, you knew your friend's behavior very, very well, and you happen to know your friend's parent, and one day you see that your friend has the exact same behavior as their parent that excites you, you want to tell your friend, and you say something like, hey, Bill, you're just like your dad. And then you back away from Bill, who goes totally ballistic and goes, how would you compare me to my dad? And almost everyone has that experience. And I say, this is the most profound story in the world. Everyone else can see that Bill behaves like his dad. The only one who doesn't see it is Bill. I say, we explain that. Because 95% of the day, Bill's thinking, his conscious mind's not paying attention, but his behavior is unflowing from the subconscious mind. And that behavior is unobserved by him. And if it's not a good behavior, he apparently was good in his business behavior, but his personal behavior is affected by all the negative programs that he got from his father. So what happens is, during the day, he's thinking, I'm trying to be the nice, good person and everything, and 95% of the day, he's playing his father's behavior. And it doesn't see it, and it sabotages his life. And then he looks around going, geez, I don't know why it happened. The simple bottom line is this, is that the movie The Matrix is not science fiction. The movie The Matrix is a documentary. Every one of us has had to have been programmed. That's the way nature created it. The first 7 years is how you download the operating system to get the thing off the ground to work. By age 7, you get to interact with the operating system, and that's when conscious mind can connect. So the bottom line is, we have been programmed. The programs come from other people, the fundamental basic programs, and they don't necessarily support you. And as a matter of fact, psychologists will tell you 70% or more of the programs that we got in that first 7 years are disempowering, self-sabotaging, and limiting, which means that 95% of the day, you are playing programs that are sabotaging your life, and you don't see it because your conscious mind is engaged, and all
Bruce,
you see is it's not working. It's not
Bruce,
working.
You've given us so much. Right now, I'd like to pull back for a moment and try to put this into some actual examples. For example, right now, listening to this program up in Poughkeepsie, New York, is a woman who I know and have worked with, who comes from a background where she did not have a good background as far as parental input. And every major life choice this person has made has worked against her. And I know she's listening, and now suddenly a light is going to go off and she's going to better understand why. She's been living, thinking, as we all do, that we're living our own independent lives, and we're really living through that subconscious intake early in life, and then improperly reacting. We're making wrong choices, but we're making the right choice that the father in this case would have made. It's just the wrong choice for her. And so you've given us some profound insights. Let me give you a few items to feedback to us, if you will, please. All right? When I was at the Institute of Applied Biology, and I was a postdoctoral fellow, and I was observing something. I was observing how downstairs on the main floors, the first two floors, all the scientists were working on chemotherapy, for example. And they had thousands and thousands of rats, which were kept in little boxes, which were kept in racks, and they were given a standard rat chow and some water, and that's it. And then when the experiment didn't work, there was next put on their card, and then they were gassed out, meaning they were suffocated the next morning. And the attendants did that. So I took a bunch of those rats that had an X on their card at night, because I worked at night. They didn't. I took them upstairs. And I had this whole space that had been for storage, and I cleaned it all out. And with Elena, who was the assistant director of the institute, I said, let me use this space. She said, fine, no one else using it. And I said, I want all the rats. And I told her, I said, I'm going to take all the rats that are going to be killed, and I want to see what happens if we just put them in a different environment. So, fine. And I had at one time over 1,000 rats up there, but no cages. They were given soft classical music, full spectrum lighting. They had organic foods. I never once was bitten in 33 years. It would freak other people out who came upstairs to see all these rats. And you have your favorite ones, the ones that every day they're in that right space. When they come in, sit down, they want to be right there to look at you. They lived an average of 22% longer. When I brought this to the attention of the director of the Institute, he said, well, that's not possible. And he didn't believe me. And so I had to do the experiment over. This time, he selected the rats. They numbered the rats. And then every week, they would count the rats. And at the end of a year and a half, I was right. They lived almost 25% longer. Why? Same amount of nutrients, just different sources. They had freedom to explore. They were able to interrelate with other rats. There was no cannibalism. And though they acknowledged that it was true, they would not allow the Institute to publish a study on it because it was so radical. As he said to me once, and mind you, this is where Dr. Lawrence Lacham was doing his classic work as well, and I knew Lawrence very well about the psychology of belief, and he was able to predict healthy women, completely healthy women, who would develop breast cancer based upon early life experiences, and he was correct. And that was one of the major books in the field outside of Hansaye. And I said, why won't you publish the articles that I do? And he said, because they lie outside of what most scientists could accept. And I said, but science shouldn't be orthodox. When science becomes orthodox, and by consensus, it ceased to be real science. And he said, well, there's very little real science. He said, but you're asking us to take a quantum leap, and we're just not going to do it. Do I believe what I saw myself? Yes. Do I believe that energy can be transferred from a human to an animal and a human to a human? I've seen it. Yes. Will I go out and pronounce it? No, I will not. Status quo, protecting the value of a current belief, which means, in effect, protecting the values, the social rituals, and the beliefs behind our conditioning. Okay, now, Bruce, let me put this in context, and then if you would please, then from your understanding of epigenetics, give us an understanding of this. Here I have people listening right now. 90% of them will listen regularly, but only 10% will use the information in any meaningful way that they hear from you, from me, from other sources, and only 5% of 100 will really embrace it and see results. Then I do a health support group, and there they come every 2 weeks for a couple hours, and we give them insights. And afterwards, I see some sitting at a fast food restaurant having hamburgers and sodas after I just did 2-hour discussion of what's wrong with animal protein and sugar. But it's not, they want to be there, and they'll tell you, I want to be there, but then they don't actualize it. Only a small percentage of the people actually coming to health, to a health support group, actualize, probably 10%. In fact, we'll have as much as a 90% dropout rate. We get new people in, so it takes at least 2 months of people dropping out until we finally have enough to scientifically do a scientifically valid study for another 3 months or 6 months. Now, then I do this. I found out early in my career that the only way I could really help people is if they were in a controlled environment. So I've done about, I'm going to guess, in the neighborhood of 300 to 400 of these retreats. And this is the last one I did back in April. Let me just give you a little background. I never interview a single person that comes, and I tell them I'm not there to treat disease. But last time, 7 people with terminal illness came. And one was a woman came from South Africa, the one he just mentioned. And I didn't know if anyone was a physician. I don't ask their background, but there were 4 physicians there, medical doctors, including an orthodox oncologist who was there, and not a person favorably inclined to accept alternative approaches to anything. And one of the leading, it turns out, one of the top 10 leading female oncologists in America. Lots of money, lots of patients, and lots of dead patients. So anyhow, this woman couldn't walk at all, couldn't move her legs. She had been in a wheelchair for 8 years. She hadn't moved her legs in 8 years. She had multiple sclerosis for 23 years, and she had been using walkers and wheelchairs for 13 to 16 years. Anyhow, she came because a cousin listened to the show and said, maybe you should try this. But at my retreats, we don't treat disease. We don't discuss disease. It's all about behavior. Much of what you suggest is discussed. And we do a lot of love, laughter, sitting with butterflies, monarch butterfly in a butterfly house, looking at swans on a lake, eating in silence, having classes where we get our hands in the soil and learn how to grow sprouts, and cooking classes, the things that really give people joy. And this woman had two people. One would lift a foot up and put it down. She was on a walker. Then another one would lift a foot up and put it down. So without these people, her feet wouldn't move at all. But I asked her a simple question. I said, you're telling me your husband and your brothers and sisters are all medical doctors. She said, all of them. And your father was the personal physician of Nelson Mandela. She said, yeah, we live right across the street. He was on one side, we were on the side. We've been friends for decades. And you've tried everything. She said, I've tried everything orthodox has to do, but I also tried everything, stem cell research, herbs, homeopathy, hyperbaric oxygen. I've tried it, everything in the world. Because money was not an issue and access was not an issue, but nothing worked. And I said, was there ever a time in your life where you felt that if you could have lived your life over, you would have made other choices? He said, I don't understand the question. I said, well, you know, everyone succeeds at mastering many things in their life. And everyone generally succeeds at and does well at whatever they do. But looking back, was that the ideal that you should have done? In other words, should have you mastered something else? She said, I've never thought about that. I said, would you please think about that? And so that was her challenge. If she could live her life over, what different choices would she make? And then I have a part of the discussion called living your life in reverse, to really spend time going backwards from this moment and really analyzing every choice you've made, who was a part of the choice, what you were thinking, what you weren't thinking, and how you end up coming to the results of the choice you made, whether it was good or bad. And you go clear back, and then using hypnosis to go back further to that time before, generally before 10 years old, where we're not clear on the choices we made, because as you said, we're really sponges for everything that someone else is doing or not doing, and sometimes not giving us the attention. Like a lot of parents today, they have nannies and other people and private schools and tutors and 1,000 classes, but they don't give their kids unlimited time of themselves. And sometimes that's all a kid wants. And that comes out in different ways. So anyhow, that's what I did. Well, she started to make improvements. But so did all the other people make improvements. And on the last day, when we were having lunch, and I asked people, would you like to make any comments? People were making comments. And this woman held up her hand and she says, my whole body's feeling different. I've never felt this way. And I said, tell us what you feel. She said, I feel energy. I didn't have any feelings. I felt nothing. You could stick a pin in my leg, I wouldn't feel it. And I said, okay, well, stand up. So the people went to help her, and she's no, I'll get up. So she got on her walker. I then asked her, take your walk away and walk towards me. Mind you, this is end-stage multiple sclerosis. You won't find a person on the planet that's done this, ever. And she walked right across the dining floor to me, and everyone had the cameras out, and suddenly, up comes these doctors who didn't identify themselves as doctors during the whole retreat, and they started overflowing with what they saw. Now, why did this happen? What was going on that allowed people that they came with tumors and now a guy pulled up his shirt. He said, 44 years working at the National Institutes of Health. I didn't know that. She says, I've had this tumor on my back here the size of an orange, and I wear these baggy outsized shirts. Nobody pays attention to it for 7 years, and this morning I get up, and it's gone. A woman says, I did too, under my arm. I took a shower, lathered up, had to shower again because I couldn't find it. And I never explain to people what happens. I just simply say, if you've been given a gift, give a gift to others in your life who need it. Could you explain what happens, and I know it's happened to you and others, when you have people in a more controlled environment where they can't go have a hot dog, a hamburger, french fries. They can't turn on a reality show. They can't get on the telephone and hear someone malign, gossip, or demean. That they can't have arguments. It's a controlled environment of peace, harmony, and love, like Krishnamurti used to have, like you have had, like many others have had. Talk about what's really happening that fits into the idea of new programs, and conscious awareness in your environment. The forum is yours.
Well, I'm so excited by all that because, of course, this is a complete understanding of where the new biology comes in. And it really talks about the fact, remember I said I put cells in the culture environment and the culture medium controls the fate of the cells. And the question is, how fast does it take to do that? And the thing is, well, I can grow the cells in one culture medium, pull that culture medium out, add a different version of the culture medium in a very short time, sometimes within minutes. The cells will change because I've changed the chemistry of the environment, the blood, the equivalent of blood. And so I say, well, this is exactly the same thing that occurs in our body. When we change our thinking, the chemistry from our brain is changing the composition of the blood. When we have very positive thoughts and we get amazing healing, such as you described, people frequently refer to that as the placebo effect. I go, the placebo effect is real. Basically, it's an image in the mind that whatever this thing is, this drug, this process, this therapy, is this is the one. This is going to work. So the vision is already like, oh, this is going to work. So the mind has already accepted, I am going to be healed. And as a result, the chemistry of the brain released in that picture is chemistry of healing. And all of a sudden, we have that placebo effect. And I say, well, the sugar pill didn't do the healing. It was the belief. I say, yeah, but the belief was turned into chemistry, which went into the blood. And I said, the cells are like programmable chips. As soon as you change the environment, the program can change on the inside. And everyone goes, yeah, I got it. The placebo effect is when I have this very positive experience, I am now creating a blood chemistry that matches that and that, you know, facilitates my health. What people have not owned and recognized is it's not just the positive thinking that is generating chemistry. Negative thinking generates chemistry equally powerfully, but the chemistry from a negative thought is disempowering chemistry and actually can shut down growth mechanisms, and it puts us in a state of protection. And protection is not growth. Protection is shutting down. And the relevance then is a negative thought is equally powerful in changing our biology because a negative thought is turned into chemistry that complements that thought and then adjusts the biology so the biology becomes an expression of the mind. A positive mind will then create a positive chemistry that supports health, and a negative one can shut down the health and create all the problems you're talking about. Now, the interesting part about why it was so important when you take people out of their environment and put them into another environment, the stimuli in the new environment are not the same stimuli that they were living in the old environment. In a new environment, the stimuli may not push those buttons that the old environment stimuli were pushing and created all that negative havoc in our system because the stimuli coming in put us into protection or whatever. Nocebo effect, it's called in biology, the opposite of placebo, a negative biology. And this becomes really important for us to understand that then as we're having these thoughts or responding to the stimuli, we're adjusting our biology and how we perceive the stimuli. You offer them a new environment, new stimuli, and all of a sudden, the old behaviors aren't called up anymore at that moment. Why? There's no stimuli to push any of the old tapes, and they do great. In fact, there was an interesting study, the same kind of idea, dealing with type 2 diabetes. They took people out of their environment, and in 30 days, putting them on a raw food diet, they were all, you know, no longer diabetic. Because type 2 diabetes is an environmental issue. It's a response to the environment. So they take them out, put them in the treat like you did, and they heal themselves. But what was different, and perhaps in your case, is when these people went back to the environment they came from, 9 out of 10 of those individuals reverted back to diabetes again. And what it really showed was diabetes is a reflection of a negative environment because when you took them out of that negative environment, put them in the retreat environment, it didn't affect them anymore. And it's really interesting because multiple sclerosis is identified as what is called an autoimmune disease. By definition, the Latin term of autoimmune means self-destructive. And what this woman was involved with was that her mind, with whatever programs were limiting her and preventing her from expressing her true self, it just felt totally disempowered throughout the entire thing. And that loss of power was reflected. She has no power to move her limbs. She wasn't able to do anything. She changed her environment, changed her view of the stimuli coming in. That's what you were helping. Change the view of the stimuli coming in. And the result is, remember, the brain is just translating the stimuli into chemistry. The new, very healthy, supportive stimuli actually change the programming, because each cell is a programmable chip. The chemistry from that thought, that new stimuli, the new environment, was chemistry that encouraged health. And guess what? Those sick cells all of a sudden were switching culture medium. They got good culture medium, and the cells got reprogrammed. And that's how fast it can really occur. And it's really important to recognize that this was totally a reflection that her mind unconsciously had been sabotaging her body, because her programs in there were limitations. And once you freed her up of those limitations, the chemistry of the body changed, and the programming changed on the cells, epigenetics, and she healed herself. And this is also an understanding, as you said, why 5% or so of those people that show up listen to all the things you do and participate in what you do, and they stay healthy. The other ones you mentioned leave, and all of a sudden they're at the hamburger place. And I go, why? And we go back. Remember, on an average day-to-day basis, 95% of the behavior is coming from the subconscious. So they come into your program, unusual environment, really cool. Conscious mind is very alert. The conscious mind is the one that's listening to all the wonderful things you're talking about. When the program let out and they walked out of the program, then all of a sudden the thinking was going on a lot, and the subconscious program kicked in, and the subconscious program said, oh, hamburger stand, let's go get one. Even though just moments before, the conscious mind was totally aware this wasn't really a great idea, but the moment they step outside, they revert back into the program and unconsciously find themselves at that hamburger stand. So the significant part that you were offering was you offered a new environment with new stimuli, which offered the biology to adapt and adjust itself. And this is really good. And yet, and here's the problem. Remember, we talked about there's a conscious mind with wishes and desires, the things that we would really love, health, happiness, relationships. And the subconscious mind has got all these other programs in it. And the fact is, we will default to those programs. And then I say, yeah, but what else? I say, well, the conscious mind just was in Gary's program and learned all this fabulous information. I say, well, that does it mean that person doesn't have any awareness of that information when they went to the hamburger place? I go, no, wait. The conscious mind learned it. And it is a reality of the conscious mind, so that if that person stayed in their conscious mind, they would be operating from those principles. The unfortunate part that you brought up, and that the part that we really have to understand, is just because they learned the principles in their conscious mind, it does no way translate to changing the program in the subconscious mind. There are two different ways they learn. The conscious mind is creative. It can learn by going to the lecture, reading the self-help book, watching a video. It can go, aha, and the conscious mind can change. The subconscious mind is a habit mind. It doesn't learn in the same way. Habit is, well, if you want to read the self-help book, then read it like a couple of dozen times in a row. Maybe repetition is what makes habit, okay? Reading it once educated the conscious mind, did not change the subconscious. Taking a person from the outside, bring them into your program, educated their conscious mind. Yeah, they knew damn well that hamburger wasn't a good idea. But when they walked outside, remember, now they're in the world of 95% controlled by subconscious. Well, that didn't learn anything in the retreat. It still had the same program. So they find themselves in the hamburger stand, driven by the subconscious mind, and all the while not even thinking about what they're doing, because their conscious mind's way off, not even paying attention to what's going on. So we have to recognize that. And I had to do this myself, because originally when I started talking about the nature of epigenetics and how powerful we are in controlling our lives and telling them about, oh, this is your, you know, this is a programming thing. And I remember my first lectures, I go in there and say, if you understand what I'm talking about, you can create the most fabulous life. And those people would look at me with their heads cocked and go, you know, Lipton, your life doesn't look so good. And I, all of a sudden, I find myself in a trap. It was sort of like, oh, do as I say, not as I do, because I realized, even though this was in my conscious mind, all this new science, I was still operating from my conventional subconscious program. So in the classroom, yeah, I could tell you about all the wonderful stuff, but the moment I walk out the door, 95% of my life was controlled by the old program. I didn't advance. I didn't change. I still had the same life.
Bruce, yeah. Now I appreciate that. I'm going to mention something quickly, then I want you to take the rest of the show to answer my last concern. What you have mentioned makes complete sense. There is one additional element, however, I'd like for you to address. In 1974, I began a study to question whether or not there was something in the form of our energy that is transferred to mice. And these mice all had ascites tumors. They only lived about 22 days. 50 people claimed that they could help people with cancer. These weren't people. These were mice. And 6 out of the 50 did, 6 out of 6 times over a 2-year period, including Dr. Dolores Krieger, head of nursing at New York University Medical School. And from that came therapeutic touch that every nurse is taught today. There was Dr. Thomas Kruth, Order of St. Luke. There was Rabbi Abraham Wiseman. There was the chiropractor, Dr. Morton Jacobs. There was Catherine Coleman, and the great spiritual healer from England who did it from England, Harry Edwards. And now there is something, the rats had nothing except the energy of the person who was meditating or praying for them. So how do you explain then an environment that is the same, the rat's still in the laboratory, but they're getting an energy from a human where there's no conversation, there's only an energy exchange from the person who is praying or meditating to the rat, and the rat's able to reverse the cancer, and they did it 6 out of 6 times, which then means it scientifically had met the standards. And it took me 12 years to get that published in the Journal of Psychotronic Research because no one understood what the hell it meant. What are you talking about energy? What are you talking about energy exchange? What are you saying that a rat was terminally ill and now someone prayed and they got well? We don't understand that because it didn't fall into the molecular model, the reductionist model. Do you have an explanation for that, please?
I fully do, and I so appreciate it because this is a left-out piece of the story, and that is this. Our conventional world of medicine is based on what is called Newtonian physics, which separates energy from matter and says that the body is made out of matter, and things made out of matter are not influenced by the invisible field, the energy. And this is what separated mind and body a long time ago. Mind is energy, body is matter. And they say, well, mind is energy. The body is not affected by energy. And therefore, mind has been left out of medicine, except they always had a problem with the placebo-nocebo effect, which clearly revealed that the mind was working, but they just couldn't figure it out, and they left it out. The issue is this. Quantum physics, which came in 1925, revealed that the universe is not made out of energy and matter, that everything is made out of energy. Matter is made out of energy. And you go, what do you mean? I can feel it and touch it and physically feel it. I go, no. Matter, when you take the atom apart and you say, oh, yeah, inside is electrons, protons, and neutrons. I go, yeah, but what was inside of that? That's when the scientists got curious. What was deeper? And when they went inside those primary particles, they found there was nothing physical. It was just energy vortices like nano tornadoes. And so basically an atom isn't even physical at all. And the only way we can see something is, remember, if energy is invisible. So I'm telling you, your atoms are made out of energy, and therefore you made out of atoms should be invisible. I say, yeah, but when photons of light from the sun or from a light bulb or from wherever it is are hitting the surface of our body, the nano tornadoes of energy repulse that light, reflect it back. So basically, when you look at something and you see it, the only reason you see it is because the photons of light are hitting the surface of an invisible energy but are reflected back. So you're seeing the surface as a reflection of photons. There's no real physical structure. And I say, so what's relevant? What's relevant is quantum physics recognizes the simple fact that the matter form of energy, energy that appears to be like matter, is intimately connected to the other form of energy, which is the invisible stuff. And in fact, there's a quote by Albert Einstein that just encapsulates it. And I say the quote, and people still like, oh, that's nice. I go, no, this is the truth. And the quote is, the field, which represents the invisible energy, the field is the sole governing agency of the particle. Particle means matter. The field is energy. Albert Einstein's quote, the field, the energy, is the sole governing agency of the particle. And I say, well, why is that relevant? Because thought is energy. And you say, yeah, I could see this energy if I put wires on your head. It's called EEG. I can read your brain activity. Yeah, I can see your brain is making electromagnetic fields. And yet what people don't recognize is there's a new way of reading brain activity, and it's called not electroencephalograph, EEG. It's called magnetoencephalograph, MEG. I say, what's different? And here's what's important. The probe does not touch the head. The probe that reads your brain activity is outside of your head. I say, what does that mean? And I say, well, the idea that your thoughts are contained in your head, that's not true. Your thoughts are broadcast to the field. You can read them outside. And then what becomes interesting is that in the understanding of quantum physics, energy can become entangled, meaning one form of energy can connect to another form of energy and change each other. It's called interference. One form of interference, two energies come together and they're more powerful. Another form of interference is two energies come together, they cancel each other out. Well, that's all kinds of physics. There's an expression that people have of these energy interactions. Constructive interference, where the energy gives you more power, we call it good vibes. Destructive interference, where two energies come together and cancel each other out, is referred to as bad vibes. What's the point? We feel vibes. We feel the energy. And the energy is telling us about what's going on in the field. The relevance is that a human energy of consciousness, when focused, is like a laser beam that will send that energy to interact or interfere with whatever energy is the intention of the focus. So the relevance is a human thought is not contained in the head. It's broadcast into the field. That thought can, the energy of that thought can engage with the energy of anything. Remember, an energy is not just the invisible stuff. It's matter. So a thought can change matter, and that's quantum physics. It's called entanglement. And so the idea is when you had the meditators in the room, their thoughts were entangling with the rats. And what they were doing, in some sense, was reducing the stress of the rats. When the rats were experiencing the thoughts of that person, to the rat, that would be the equivalent of a good vibe. Hey, this is good. My life is good. I feel very positive about things. Those rats do better. And so the fact is this, prayer, intention, thought are forms of broadcasting energy into the environment with the intention of being a focus on other things in the environment so we can send our thoughts back and forth. It's always been that way. In ancient history, people always communicated without words even because the thoughts were going back and forth. We have that ability, but we don't exercise it, so therefore we depend on language. But we could get engaged. As a matter of fact, when people are very close together, like couples, they actually start to read each other's thoughts even, you know, without the language. That, oh, you know, they could start a sentence and the other one would finish it because they're on the same thought. That's what the ultimate understanding would be. So the idea is this. Okay. When people are sending out very positive vibes, in other words, vibrations that are in harmony with life and energizing and all that, it will affect those that are at a lower energy level through a process called quantum entanglement. And that quantum entanglement leads to what is called an interference, where the energy of the broadcaster is interfering with the energy of the recipient. And I said, well, there are two ways those energies can interact, two extremes. One is the two energies can boost each other, and that's expressed as good vibes. That's like when you go someplace and all of a sudden you meet some people and you have more power. All of a sudden you feel so much energy. I say, oh, yeah, the two energies are coming together, and that enhances the positive nature. And then in contrast, you've probably been someplace where all of a sudden you felt your energy disappear, like you were in fear, like you were in a lost and you didn't know where you were, or you were concerned something was up, and all of a sudden you feel your energy going away. Well, that's vibes, but it's bad vibes, but it's an energy in the field affecting you.
Bruce, so, we appreciate, yeah. We're out of time, but we appreciate this hour. I'm going to invite you back for one of our Tuesday night progressive commentary hours where we can continue our discussion.
I would love that and appreciate it, and I want to thank you and for your audience for looking at a better way to be on this planet. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Bruce Lipton, Conversations with Remarkable Minds, Epigenetics Behind Emotions, Beliefs, and Behaviors. I'm Gary Null. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.